Como parte de la colaboración bilateral en materia de seguridad, ha solicitado a Estados Unidos el apoyo de aviones no tripulados para la obtención de información específica. El gobierno de Felipe Calderón destacó que las operaciones estadounidenses en territorio nacional no violan la Constitución mexicana. Por su parte, el general y académico mexicano José Francisco Gallardo denunció la política de militarización del presidente Felipe Calderón.
La política de militarización que existe por parte de Calderón es una política impuesta desde el Pentágono, desde el Departamento de Defensa y desde la Casa Blanca, porque al militarizar las estructuras políticas, económicas, a nivel global, principalmente en América Latina, tiene que ver con la lucha por la hegemonía a nivel internacional. Que lo que estamos viendo nosotros es que cada vez que se encuentra en crisis el sistema capitalista global, ahora el neoliberalismo, pues Estados Unidos inventa una guerra, y bueno, ellos tienen una industria bélico-militar en donde venden armas a gran escala, sí, destruyen los países, luego los construyen, pero toda la reconstrucción se la dan a empresas estadounidenses que a través de capitales especulativos pues tienen una injerencia en el orden interno de los países donde están sus bases militares y principalmente donde tienen una ocupación militar o una anexión como lo que está pasando en México.
El general José Francisco Gallardo pasó 9 años preso por criticar las violaciones a los derechos humanos de las Fuerzas Armadas Mexicanas y proponer una comisión que investigara dichos abusos. Regresamos a Noticias de Japón, donde siguen los esfuerzos para rescatar a los sobrevivientes y encontrar a miles de desaparecidos después del terremoto de 9 grados que causó amplia destrucción en el país asiático. Telesur informa.
Las labores de remoción de escombros y búsqueda de sobrevivientes continúa en las áreas más devastadas. La nieve obstaculiza las operaciones de rescate. Aumentan las penurias de los evacuados. No hay electricidad, hay escasez de combustible, alimentos y agua potable. El racionamiento del vital líquido es extremo.
Estamos proporcionando unos 3 litros de agua por persona. Esperamos que dure lo suficiente.
El aeropuerto Haneda de Tokio registró este miércoles un repunte en el tránsito de pasajeros. El éxodo de residentes se incrementa en medio de la emergencia nuclear.
La situación nuclear es la más preocupante. Mis hijos son pequeños y tienen su vida delante de ellos. Y no quiero que se contaminen con la lluvia radioactiva. La planta de Fukushima nuclear es la más preocupante.
La alarma internacional por el aumento de las emisiones radioactivas eclipsa la otra tragedia humana que viven quienes siguen en territorio japonés.
Ella es Reiko Miura. Recorre lo que un día fue la ciudad de Otsuchi al noreste del país. Busca entre los escombros algún rastro de su sobrino desaparecido desde el terremoto de magnitud 9 en la escala de Richter. El lodo y las viviendas destruidas vuelven desolador el panorama. Ella dice que su hermana mayor no puede venir hasta acá a buscar su hijo, debido a que tiene una pierna enferma y por eso está allí. Entre sollozos recorre la zona con la esperanza de encontrar alguna persona con vida, en particular su sobrino. Hasta el momento solo han sido rescatadas 25.000 personas. Mientras, en la ciudad de Koriyama se han dispuesto de varios refugios para los damnificados. Este afectado dice que está muy confundido por la situación de inestabilidad en el país y que las informaciones son muy complejas. Ante la posible presencia de sustancias tóxicas en Koriyama, las autoridades evacúan a los residentes de la ciudad. La tragedia que vive Fukushima es considerada la peor desde el accidente nuclear ocurrido en Chernóbil, Ucrania, en 1986.
En Estados Unidos se observa con mucha atención cómo el complejo nuclear Fukushima Daiichi de Japón se convierte en una creciente pesadilla que incluye incendios, fugas de radiación y evacuaciones masivas de la población cerca del lugar. En California, las farmacias reportan una masiva compra de pastillas con potasio y yodo, las que supuestamente prevendrán que la gente adquiera cáncer en la glándula tiroide si es expuesta a la radiación nuclear de Japón. La doctora Vicky Hufnagel dice que en caso de que la radiación llegue a California, la gente debe taparse el cabello y todo el cuerpo y usar lentes y gafas cuando salga fuera de su casa. Evitar salir fuera durante los días en que hay concentración o cuando las partículas radioactivas se avecinan y seguir de cerca la información pertinente en sitios de gobierno o en el sitio web theethicaltimes.org. También recomienda lavarse las manos y todo el cuerpo con jabón con yodo, usar abrigo largo y lavarlo una vez a la semana con el mismo limpiador. Cuando se lave el cuerpo, dice, dejar el jabón en la piel entre 3 o 5 minutos antes de enjuagarse. También usar Q-tips, pequeños palitos de cartón o de papel con una bolita de algodón en la punta para limpiarse la nariz y los oídos y remover cualquier fragmento, pues esos fragmentos no deben permanecer dentro ni en cualquier parte de la piel. Señala que la limpieza de la nariz y oídos debe hacerse con suavidad, evitando provocar rozaduras y laceraciones en la piel, pues una persona expuesta a la radiación, cualquier herida que tenga tenderá a infectarse y a no sanar. Señala que las personas que usan sal de mar deben descontinuarla y usar sal yodada. Además, comprar vitaminas que contengan como 30 miligramos de potasio y yodo e ingerirlas todos los días. La doctora Hufnagel dice que si alguien en la familia padece la enfermedad lupus, acaba de tener un trasplante de un órgano o tiene deficiencia en su inmunidad, debe consultar con un médico acerca de la cantidad adecuada de potasio y yodo que debe tomar. En los próximos días estaremos reportando sobre las plantas nucleares en San Onofre y San Luis Obispo en California, así como en el resto de los Estados Unidos. También sobre los peligros y costos de la industria nuclear, sus nexos con el militarismo y las alternativas para generar electricidad usando el viento y los rayos del sol. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
En medio de protestas de maestros y padres de familia, la Junta del Distrito Escolar Unificado de Los Ángeles, LAUSD por sus siglas en inglés, favoreció a las escuelas semiprivadas, conocidas como charters, con la adjudicación de 7 planteles. La discusión duró más de 5 horas y media por 10 campuses escolares, incluidas 7 preparatorias y 3 escuelas con bajo desempeño académico, que servirán a unos 20.000 estudiantes el año próximo. Las escuelas charters reciben fondos públicos, pero son manejadas de manera privada y no permiten la sindicalización de su personal. El Sindicato de Maestros de Los Ángeles criticó la decisión en medio de la crisis actual y los drásticos recortes que se avecinan. En lugar de luchar por las mejoras de las escuelas, el LAUSD prefiere regalarlas, dijo a J. Duffy, el presidente de los maestros. Este martes, unos 7.000 maestros y personal educativo de California recibieron su notificación de despido. El déficit que enfrenta California es la justificación para los recortes en la educación. El gobernador Jerry Brown propone a los electores votar por una extensión de impuestos para prevenir recortes en programas sociales. Y llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
This is Yao from Aslan Underground. You're listening to Radio Libre Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. Listen online at freakradio.org. Yo, fuck the system. Fuck centralized power structure. Fuck Arizona. Unlicensed, commercial-free, pirate radio, cabrones.
Yo, yo, yo. B-side players and maíz. Cruzando fronteras. Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. Check it out, www.freakradio.org. Radio.org, cruzando fronteras. Yeah!
Besides? ¿Qué pasa, mi gente? Mi nombre es Boca Floja del Distrito Federal, pero escuchándonos por el Radio Libre 101.fm para todo el mundo. No habrá más paz sin justicia. Chequen la página www.freakradio.org. Respeto, Boca Floja. Chido.
We are in need of any donations to the station to help with many costs to run a non-commercial, not-for-profit, out-of-your-pocket radio station. Please send donations to FRSC, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061, or PayPal at freakradio.org/donate.html. Recently, we've been getting more Spanish bilingual programs like Radio Trabajadora, The Spanish Show, Radio Machete, Yomer's Sideshow, among others. Also, Iraq Vets Against the War, IVAW, does a program talking about their experiences in the war. We're still airing Democracy Now! Twice every weekday, along with morning news shorts from WIN, the Workers' Independent News, the 420 Drug War News, Mumia Abu-Jamal Commentaries, Free Press Media Minutes, Weekly Radio Spin, and more. Every weekday morning from 7:30 to 8 a.m. We also have old schoolers like Robert Norris, Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor. Also Phil Free's Morning Thunder program, Uncle Dennis with From the Cream to the Dregs, and Pop Defect Radio programs, popdefectradio.blogspot.com. Check out our schedule online, freakradio.org/schedule, and listen online, freakradio.org/listen. And, of course, if you're in Santa Cruz, tune in to 101.1 FM, 100 watts of stereo madness.
And be sure to tune in to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. That's with me, Robert Norris, on 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org every Thursday night, 6 to 8 p.m. And, of course, every Sunday morning from 9:30 all the way to 1 p.m. If you're game.
Hi, this is Mauro in the Tangerine Dream Team. 101.1 FM, Santa Cruz, Free and Wild Radio Preserve. Because baby guitars need a place to play.
And coming up next on Free Radio, it hopefully is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Stay tuned.
Are you tired of living in a fascist state, but aren't sure what to do about it? Tune into Resistance and Renewal here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, Friday nights from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Find out what's going on and what people are doing to create change. Join me, Louie, as we resist the empire and talk about how to transform our planet. Together we have the power. We are the ones we've been waiting for.
This is Boots Riley from The Coup. And whenever I'm running from the police, I gotta find out where to go. I listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
If you work for peace, stop paying for war. For more information, call the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee at 1-800-269-7464. That's 1-800-269-7464.
Hi, we're the Devil Makes Three.
Yeah.
And we listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1.
Arr! There was no feeling in that.
There was no
feeling.
This time with feeling. Hello, we're the Devil Makes Three. When we're not illegally downloading music from the internet, we're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.5 FM. Through every station in the house.
101.1, dude.
101.1, you fucked it up. Okay, let's try that again.
No way, that's the one.
Japanese winter. The earth quakes, and the land of the rising sun becomes a nation of tears and fears. Tsunamis splash black water over miles of farmland, and cars bob around like inflatables in a bathtub. Then, with power downed by rushing waters, nuclear power plants overheat, and we hear a word not heard for decades. Meltdown. It is too early to offer a definitive death toll, but already endangered is the popularity of nuclear power plants. It comes only months after the Obama administration pronounced its support for nuclear plant construction, an echo of sorts of its corporate-backed endorsement of deep-sea oil drilling, shortly before the BP Deep Horizon oil spill of summer 2010. Of the top 30 nations utilizing nuclear energy, Japan is right in the middle, generating almost 30% of its energy needs. It is the irony of ironies that the only nation that experienced a nuclear bomb attack, Japan, is now threatened by meltdowns caused by natural disaster. The country bombed by the U.S. experienced black rain and mass death. This disaster, now upon it, wrought black waves and thousands of deaths. Truly, it is winter in Japan. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Our guest on the most recent Cultural Baggage show was Joseph Collum, author of The Black Dragon, Racial Profiling Exposed.
People always ask me, what, do I consider state police to be racist, or these troopers who are engaged in this practice to be racist? And I can't tell you what's in somebody's heart, you know, what's in somebody's mind. If they're doing this because they are prejudiced against blacks or minorities. But I do know that one of the big motivations in the case of New Jersey was, and the big carrot that was hung out there for troopers, was the Trooper of the Year Award. And that was like winning the Heisman Trophy for a college football player, or winning an Oscar for a Hollywood actor. To be Trooper of the Year, there were 2,700 troopers, and you were singled out as the Trooper of the Year. And you became an instant legend. You're on the express elevator for the career advancement. And other troopers stood aside when you walked into a room if you were Trooper of the Year. And invariably, year after year after year, the Trooper of the Year was the trooper who made the most drug arrests on the Jersey Turnpike.
Right.
And that created literally a feeding frenzy among troopers who were patrolling the turnpike.
As my understanding, that the methods of the New Jersey State Troopers were used as a template exposed, or that procedure given to other law enforustment agencies around
Absolutely.
The country.
Absolutely. The state police really developed the techniques that became racial profiling in this context. Profiling, in essence, the way it was done in New Jersey on the turnpike was, because you had a captive audience, basically. You had the Jersey Turnpike is a toll road, and you get on in the south end of the state or the north end of the state, and a lot of people drive all the way down, all the way through. And because people were coming or going from New York City, the state police believed that a percentage of people were carrying drugs. And what they did was, this practice was officially was called highway drug interdiction, but what it was literally a dragnet that was set up on the highway. And troopers were taught that if they stopped, an individual trooper stopped 20 to 25 to 30 cars a day to search them for drugs, that added up to, over the course of a year, 6,000 to 7,000 cars per trooper. And if you found drugs in only 1% of those cases, that's 60 or 70 arrests a year you're making. You were a candidate for Trooper of the Year.
Again, that was Joseph Collum, author of The Black Dragon. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On Wednesday, workers, their unions, and supporters of workers' rights will rally in Lansing, Michigan to protest attacks on worker rights. It's part of a national movement defending worker rights against the coordinated national attack on workers and unions. Michigan Republicans are pushing 40 anti-union, anti-worker bills through the legislature. The Michigan AFL-CIO is urging all workers, unions, and community supporters to turn out Wednesday to protest this attack in Lansing. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says the mass workers' movement sparked in Wisconsin is an historic opportunity that must not be lost.
In your lifetime, have you ever seen this much solidarity? Have you ever seen this much excitement, this much activism? Well, let me say, as progressives, it's our job to transform the outrage and to make this moment a movement, to ensure that this corruption in the Midwest does not stand. And we have the immense responsibility to keep the fire lit, spark real change for America.
On April 6th, a federal court will hear a motion by National Football League players to order owners to lift the lockout of the players. Owners want to grab $1 billion more off the top of league revenue and force players to play more games. The AFL-CIO says it stands with the players just as members of the Green Bay Packers stand with Wisconsin public workers in their fight over collective bargaining. Dennis Kucinich connects the anti-labor dots in the Midwestern states. Jesse Russell reports.
Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich was one of the speakers at what has become known as the largest rally in Wisconsin's history on Saturday. The congressman used the opportunity to connect the dots between the battles that are unfolding in Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
In the past week, a bill has moved along that would strip the right of collective bargaining for Ohio's public workers, that would put them in harm's way should they decide to strike, because then replacement workers would come in and then would set the stage for privatization. And after all, isn't what this is all about?
Kucinich said the various pieces of legislation being proposed and passed in those states amount to a power grab by corporations who want to see the public sector privatized. He also referred to a portion of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's budget repair bill that would sell off state power plants via a no-bid contract.
What they believe in is government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. That might work on Wall Street, but it's not going to work in Wisconsin. And it's not going to work in Ohio. And it's not going to work in Michigan.
This newscast made possible in part by the National Education Association and AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Let me tell you something. FCC agents are nothing but pure dog meat. They're nothing but the lowest form of life. FCC is probably the worst thing that ever, you know, the worst scourge that's ever come upon the face of the earth.
101 FM.
101 FM.
101 FM.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We agree with everyone, the government of Japan agrees that it's very important to ensure safety when it comes to the operation of nuclear power plants.
Japan's nuclear crisis is intensifying. A second reactor unit at the damaged Fukushima plant may have ruptured and appears to be releasing radioactive steam. We'll go to Japan to get the latest, and we'll speak with a former member of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But first, former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has decided to return to Haiti after living in exile in South Africa for 7 years. The U.S. is urging him to postpone his trip.
Former President Aristide has chosen to remain outside of Haiti for 7 years. To return this week can only be seen as a conscious choice to impact Haiti's elections.
Amy Goodman is in South Africa to cover Aristide's return trip to Haiti. She'll join us from Johannesburg. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Japan's nuclear crisis is intensifying. A second reactor unit at the damaged Fukushima plant may have ruptured and appears to be releasing radioactive steam. It's unclear how serious the breach might be, but the vessel that possibly ruptured is the last fully intact line of defense against large-scale releases of radioactive material. Several explosions have hit the plant since Friday's devastating earthquake. The radiation levels around the plant are so high that Japanese authorities abandoned efforts to dump water from military helicopters to cool the reactors. More emergency workers are expected to return to the plant today after radiation levels forced their evacuation. Meanwhile, damaging revelations about the nuclear reactor used in the plant are coming to light. Components in the reactor have come under criticism since as far back as the early 1970s. Developed by General Electric, the plant's nuclear reactors use a containment vessel surrounding the reactors that are less robust than other models. The design is also used in 23 reactors at 16 American plants. Marketed as a cheaper and easier to build, the Mark I boiling water reactor drew criticism in 1972 from the Atomic Energy Commission, which said the equipment presented unacceptable safety risks and should be discontinued. In the mid-1980s, an official with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said the Mark I stood a 90% chance of bursting should the fuel rods overheat and melt in an accident. as Japan attempts to prevent nuclear catastrophe, the recovery effort from the earthquake and tsunami continues. The official toll of the dead and missing has now passed 11,000. We'll have more on Japan later in the broadcast. In Bahrain, state forces have launched what appears to be a vicious assault on protesters in the capital, Manama. Earlier today, troops backed by tanks and helicopters stormed the Pearl roundabout, the epicenter of protests over the last month. At least two protesters were reportedly killed and hundreds wounded after Bahraini forces attacked them from all sides and fired tear gas into the crowds. Some witnesses reported firing from U.S.-supplied Apache helicopters. The attack comes one day after the Bahraini government declared a state of emergency. While over 1,000 Saudi and United Arab Emirate troops have entered Bahrain to support the ruling monarchy, it's unclear if any foreign soldiers were involved in today's violence. Bahrain is a key U.S. ally in the Middle East. On a visit to Egypt just hours before the attack, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called for restraint on all sides.
We call for common restraint on all sides. In Bahrain, we're particularly concerned about increasing reports of provocative acts and sectarian violence by all groups. The use of force and violence from any source will only worsen the situation and create a much more difficult environment in which to arrive at a political solution.
Clinton spoke during her first visit to Egypt since the popular uprising that overthrew the U.S.-backed President Hosni Mubarak. On Tuesday, Clinton was snubbed by the main coalition of Egyptian youth groups that spearheaded the anti-Mubarak protests. In a statement, the January 25th Revolution Youth Coalition said it had turned down an invitation to meet Clinton, saying, quote, based on Clinton's negative position from the beginning of the revolution and the position of the U.S. administration in the Middle East, we reject this invitation. When the uprising began, Clinton staunchly defended Mubarak, saying, quote, our assessment is that the Egyptian government is stable and is looking for ways to respond to the legitimate needs and interests of the Egyptian people. Clinton used similar language on Tuesday to voice support for Egypt's transitional government.
I am particularly pleased that the minister and I discussed in great detail with others who were there the economic needs, the need to rebuild a police force that will have the trust of the people, and I applaud the announcement today of the dismantling of the existing state security apparatus and the rebuilding of one that will be responsive to the needs of Egyptians.
Michigan's State Assembly has given final approval to an emergency financial management bill decried by critics as an attack on workers and democracy. Under the bill, emergency financial managers would be allowed to break union contracts, dismiss elected officials, and even disincorporate entire municipalities. Republican Governor Rick Snyder is expected to sign the measure into law. Snyder is also attempting to push through a plan to tax the public and private pensions of senior citizens. Over 1,000 people held a protest outside the state capitol in Lansing Tuesday before attempting a sit-in inside. Protesters are vowing to return for another rally today. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, hundreds of people rallied at the Capitol in Nashville against a measure that would strip the collective bargaining rights of public school teachers. 7 people were arrested after disrupting a Senate hearing. 2 children have been killed in a U.S. airstrike in Afghanistan. The victims were watering fields in Afghanistan's Kunar province when they came under attack. The deaths come just 2 weeks after 9 Afghan boys were mistakenly killed by NATO gunships. Speaking in Washington, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, touted the progress of U.S. military goals in Afghanistan, but called them fragile and reversible.
It is ISAF's assessment that the momentum achieved by the Taliban in Afghanistan since 2005 has been arrested in much of the country and reversed in a number of important areas. However, while the security progress achieved over the past year is significant, it is also fragile and reversible.
Petraeus went on to suggest a scenario under which U.S. troops would remain in Afghanistan beyond a 2014 withdrawal date through the operation of joint military bases with Afghan forces. Petraeus said, quote, it's very important to stay engaged in a region in which we have such vital interests. In Libya, forces loyal to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi are shelling the rebel-held city of Misrata in an attempt to overthrow opposition forces. On Tuesday, Gaddafi's forces broke through the final line of defense protecting the rebel stronghold of Benghazi. Adabiyya is strategically critical, allowing highway access that would permit Gaddafi's troops to encircle and overrun Benghazi. Uzbekistan has expelled employees of Human Rights Watch after what the group calls years of government harassment. Human Rights Watch has recently criticized attempts by the U.S. and the European Union to repair relations with Uzbekistan, saying it should be held accountable for a human rights record that includes torture and the murder of unarmed civilians and the arbitrary jailing of activists and journalists. Uzbekistan provides a key supply route for military shipments to Afghanistan. On Tuesday, Democracy Now! Reached Steve Swerdlow, Human Rights Watch's Uzbekistan researcher.
The government of Uzbekistan has expelled Human Rights Watch from the country. This is the first time that in its 33-year history, Human Rights Watch has been forced to close any of its field offices. And this is a reflection of the increasingly dire human rights situation in Uzbekistan today. Uzbekistan has one of the worst human rights records in the world. It's synonymous with torture in its criminal justice system. It's known for forced child labor in the cotton sector. And it's also known for the continued imprisonment of dozens of human rights activists, independent journalists, and political figures. With our expulsion today, we're extremely concerned about the impact our closure will have on the increasingly isolated and beleaguered civil society in Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan, in the last several years, has played a much more increasingly strategic role with the United States in that it allows the U.S. to transit supplies to its troops, its NATO troops, to the south in Afghanistan. And for that reason, the United States and also the EU have been turning a blind eye to a worsening human rights situation there. So today, Human Rights Watch is calling on the United States and the European Union to publicly condemn the expulsion of Human Rights Watch and, more importantly, the crackdown on the remaining civil society activists.
In Utah, Republican Governor Gary Herbert has signed into law a new package of measures similar to last year's anti-immigrant crackdown in Arizona. Utah's Republican-controlled legislature approved the laws earlier this month. Immigrant rights activists are expected to challenge provisions that force law enforcement officers to check the immigration status of people stopped for violations. And the New York Times is reporting the U.S. government has begun sending pilotless drones into Mexican territory in an effort to monitor the drug trade. The secret program began with a formal agreement between President Barack Obama and Mexican President Felipe Calderon last month. Administration officials say drones helped capture suspects in the recent killing of a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent in Mexico. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has decided to return to Haiti this week ahead of Sunday's presidential runoff election. Aristide has lived in exile in South Africa since 2004, when he was ousted in a U.S.-backed coup. Amy Goodman is in South Africa to cover Aristide's return to Haiti. She joins us now from Johannesburg. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Juan. It's great to be with you. And quite amazing what is going to be taking place here in this historic country, South Africa, to do with the history of another historic country, Haiti. We flew in from New York earlier today to Oliver Tambo Airport, and just that is amazing in itself, right? He was the former president of the ANC, the late president of the African National Congress, one of the great anti-apartheid leaders. When we came in from the plane, the first image was that of Nelson Mandela, the former president of South Africa. And on all the wings of the planes are the flag of the new country of South Africa, you know, in 1994, not so new, but the symbol of peaceful revolution that took place in this country. Now, the reason we are here, though, is because President Aristide, as you said, is returning to South Africa before, is returning to Haiti before the Sunday elections that will be taking place for a new president in Haiti. This is truly historic. Regular listeners and viewers to Democracy Now! May remember back to 2004, to the second coup against Aristide. The first was in 1991, unfortunately a U.S.-backed coup that threw the democratically elected president out of office. The second was in 1994, when he was reelected, again a U.S.-backed coup. Democracy Now! Was on the plane to the Central African Republic, to Bangui, where he was flown into exile by U.S. military and U.S. security. We went in a small delegation that was led by Maxine Waters, the Los Angeles Congressmember Randall Robinson, the founder of TransAfrica, and others, to return the Aristides to the Western Hemisphere, amidst, at the time, Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, Secretary of State at the time, warning the Aristides they were not to return to the Western Hemisphere, to which Randall Robinson responded when we were on the flight, "Whose hemisphere are they talking about?" And now they return to Jamaica, ultimately in exile in South Africa, where they have been for the last 7 years. Now the Aristides are attempting to return to their country, to Haiti. I'm joined right now by KK Kane. We will both be on the plane, though last-minute negotiations are taking place between, well, the government of South Africa, the U.S., which is putting tremendous pressure on the government of South Africa not to return the Aristides to Haiti, and putting pressure on the Haitian government. As I was on that plane, and KK Kane was as well, the renowned filmmaker who's made many films on Haiti, most recently called Resistance, covered the coup in 1991 and has done many films since. We are going to hopefully return on this plane again with the Aristides to chronicle this historic journey of the Aristides and their two daughters to their country, to Haiti. KK, as you join us now, talk about the significance of this return of the Aristides, though last-minute negotiations are taking place even as we speak, with the tremendous pressure that's being brought to bear on the Aristides and the South African and Haitian governments by the U.S.
Okay, thank you, Amy, and it's a pleasure to be here. And it's certainly a pleasure to be part of this long-awaited return, which we hope will actually take place this time. The Aristides have been in exile here in South Africa for 7 years, always wanting to go home, always looking for an opportunity. At this point, they've been given passports by the Haitian government. So, according to the Haitian government, it's fine for them to return. However, there's an election next Sunday, and no matter what happens, the Haitian government will change, and we're far less secure of the new Haitian government, whether they will allow Aristide to return or not. So this is the reason that it's a small window of opportunity, which Aristide and his friends are trying to take opportunity of.
Well, Amy and KK, on Monday, the U.S. State Department urged former President Aristide to postpone his trip.
However, former President Aristide has chosen to remain outside of Haiti for 7 years. To return this week can only be seen as a conscious choice to impact Haiti's elections. We would urge former President Aristide to delay his return until after the electoral process has concluded, to permit the Haitian people to cast their ballots in a peaceful atmosphere. A return prior to the election may potentially be destabilizing to the political process.
That was State Department spokesperson Mark Toner. On Monday, we asked Aristide's attorney, Ira Kurzban, to respond.
President Aristide's desire to return home is unrelated to the election, but to a desire to be in Haiti to carry on his educational work. However, he is genuinely concerned that a change in the Haitian government may result in his remaining in South Africa. The Department of State has previously said that this is a decision for the Haitian government. They should leave the decision to the democratically elected government instead of seeking to dictate the terms under which a Haitian citizen may return to his country. The State Department statement today is full of misinformation. The claim that President Aristide voluntarily left Haiti and could have returned the past 7 years is belied by the U.S. government's active involvement in his removal as the democratically elected president of Haiti and their active role in ensuring that he remained and apparently remains in South Africa.
That was Ira Kurzban, President Aristide's longtime lawyer. Amy, your sense of why it's so important at this critical time, just before the election, for President Aristide to return?
Well, you know, it's very interesting to hear the wording of Mark Toner's statement before that. Well, now the resigned P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesperson, who had actually tweeted out at an earlier time that the Aristides should not be returning. Aristide is a Haitian citizen. He was the president of Haiti, but he will return as a resident of Haiti. And, you know, right now I have just seen a letter that's being circulated to lawyers and law professors around the United States, where they are calling on Cheryl Mills, the chief of staff of the Department of State, to criticizing the State Department statement, saying that he has every right to return. Also, the significance of who is in the State Department, people who understand that well, like Harold Koh, used to head the Human Rights Clinic at Yale University, like Michael Posner, the Assistant Secretary Michael Posner, who used to be head of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which is now called Human Rights First. The issue of the human rights and the right of freedom of expression and of a Haitian citizen to return home, of a Haitian family to return home. This is a critical moment right now. The negotiations are taking place behind the scenes. The safety of this trip is extremely important. And the pressure that the U.S. has continually brought to bear on President Aristide is one that is very important to highlight. The U.S. can change its role in the troubled relationship it has had in Haiti since the very beginning. I mean, in 1804, Haiti was the first black republic born of a slave uprising, the only country in the world. And the U.S. government would not recognize the Republic of Haiti for decades because congressmen at that time were afraid that the slave uprising would...
And so much for that. I'm going to interrupt that particular item, whatever it is. I'm having a little trouble hearing anything here because we don't seem to have good access in the studio. But you are tuned to the stream, apparently, but not the broadcast of Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org. We're going to begin a half an hour late. Bathrop's Piers, Broadsides. My apologies. For those who tuned in at 6, I was under the misimpression that we weren't going out at all, and so I didn't continue the show when I started and saw the dials all seemed to be on zero. And I've just been advised we are still streaming. So, hey, that's good news, and I hope that's the case. And I'm going to act as though it is for the next hour and a half. Stay with me. This is the March 17, 2011 edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. Stay tuned.
Think back to all the crap I learned in high school. It's a wonder I can think it all. Well, my lack of education, it hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Could I grow?
Imagine it.
We've had enough of that one. I had a little problem, though, with, again, it seems the board is getting cranky or I'm getting older. Probably the board, because usually I do pretty well here in the studio. Again, you are listening to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is a Thursday evening show concerned with civil rights in Santa Cruz. My name is Robert Norris, and I kind of work with this issue and have been leavening it for years and trying to essentially fight laws, practices, and policies that criminalize poor people or make it difficult for them, particularly in Santa Cruz, and I comment on it in other places as well. These things concern such things as the sleeping ban, the sitting ban, the panhandling ban, all the bans or severe restrictions that make it very difficult for homeless people to consider themselves even human beings in Santa Cruz under the watchful eye of their uniformed and armed betters here and in other cities as well. So I do a lot of interviewing on this subject, and I've got a few interviews that I haven't played yet, and I'm going to kind of go into those. I think I'll read a little poetry today, too, from Julia Vinograd, who you heard some poems from if you follow the show on Sunday, when I also have another version of the show from 9:30 in the morning to 1. And I got her latest book, which is called When Even the Sky Hurts. And I've kind of marked a few poems I want to read. I'll be doing that as well. And, of course, if you are able to hear the stream and you want to call in, you can. Even if you don't hear the stream and you call in, you'll probably get on the show. And the phone number here is 427-3772. Or if you're out of the area, 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. 3772. The usual reminders, if you want to pass on a public service announcement, or if you want to donate something, or if you've got questions, or particularly questions about other shows that are on the Free Radio Santa Cruz roster, you can leave a message on the phone line at 831-427-4523. 427-4523. Mostly, the best thing to do is to go to the freakradio.org website, though, and that's where you get more information, plus application forms to download. And I guess there's some archives there, too, though. My archives are stored at huffsantacruz.org, huffsantacruz.org. And again, my apologies to those of you who sat through a half an hour of preceded this show at the moment. But I also know we're having some problems with our local in-studio Winamp recorder, so I'm not really able to record it. I'm hoping it's getting recorded somewhere, because usually I have a fellow who does that, and then it gets put into the archives at that huffsantacruz.org website, and people can then go back to the show, which I think can be helpful, particularly when we have some interesting interviews on the air. So let's begin with kind of where I left off. Almost a week ago, I went up to Berkeley And I was interviewing folks on Telegraph Avenue in that last block where there used to be three bookstores. Now there are two. Cody's is closed, and there's now Moe's and Shakespeare. And there used to be a lot of folks with tables selling different kinds of items. There is still a table on the corner of Haste and Telegraph of a guy selling books at an unusually cheap price, 25 cents a book, I think, for really fine buys. I got the complete works of Cole Porter for 25 cents. I couldn't really get it. I had to lay something else on him because I didn't think that was a fair deal, but that's what was the offer. So you can sometimes get some great deals on Telegraph Avenue and also help out people who are struggling to survive. Something to remember in this treacherous economy as things dip deeper and deeper. Well, here's some an interview I did with a woman up there on Telegraph. She happened to mention that she had been traveling in Europe, and I asked her some questions about that. Actually, this was actually from some years back, but it was an interesting comparison between Europe and the United States.
Thank you, Al.
You're welcome.
So I'm talking with actually a world traveler who some years ago visited Paris. Is that right?
That is absolutely true.
And Cheryl, you're an occasional visitor to Berkeley. You're a graduate of UCB here. And you've been to Europe a couple times. When you went to Paris, you found, when you sat down on a bench, you were approached by a gendarme.
I was, and we had to pay to sit there. So if we didn't pay, we decided to move on, and we were kind of shocked because.
Were there any places where you could sit without paying in Paris?
I don't know. We just went somewhere else. But
what year was this?
Well, this is 1973, the first year I was in Paris.
So Santa Cruz doesn't have the first. Actually, it's not pay to sit. It's pay if you sit for 61 minutes. That's when you.
How many
years? More than an hour. You pay a fine if you do that.
That's in Santa Cruz. That's distinguished from Paris.
Or actually,
have you tried it out?
Have you tried it out?
Yes, we tried. We tried to get tickets. They wouldn't ticket us because they knew we were trying to test the law.
Well, if you just had some unsuspectable person sitting there, somebody, a normal person, would you have to seem like a homeless person to be hustled along?
Well, they will come up and they'll tell you, you can't sit on the bench for more than an hour. And
so what do they do? Put a mark on the bottom of your foot?
They chop your foot as they walk by. It's an efficient system. Actually, they don't, but. The intimidation factor is so strong, all they have to do is tell you, and then people start moving along.
Their nightstick and tap you on the shoulder or something.
They just advise you that it's best if you...
Best to move along. After all, we need to leave these benches for other people.
Well, the benches don't want to be abused. The benches are part of our national heritage.
Well, they are fragile, yeah. They keep sitting there forever.
They serve as a landmark, a kind of a token of a forgotten and foregone and forsaken era.
True.
We've been talking with?
This is Cheryl Schaefer.
Thank you, Cheryl. I'd like somebody to do a little research, all you free radio Santa Cruz listeners out there. Cheryl, your suggestion was?
Yeah, pay to sit in Paris, see what they say.
And say Google on the internet for that particular phrase. Pay benches in Paris. Well, so if anybody has found anything on that subject, let us know. We can attempt to pass on the news to Santa Cruz. Maybe it'll give them a whole new revenue source. Full disclosure, 73 was one thing, but when you went back there in 2008 or 2009, you found what?
Well, I don't remember having to pay to sit anywhere, so,
Well, maybe you got away with sitting down.
I don't know, or else they've totally changed their policy.
Or possibly they noticed you were a wealthy American tourist instead of a sojourning student as you were in the old days.
I do my best not to look like a wealthy American tourist, but, no one never knows.
Indeed. Well, your quality shines through.
Oh, thank you.
We're talking with
Coconut
and
TikTok.
Also
D2.
And here we are at the corner of Dwight and Telegraph. Spare anything green is the sign, and the guitar is the opportunity. What's happening in Berkeley, folks?
Nothing. Trying to get drunk. That's what's happening.
Yeah, pretty much.
No hassles here?
Not for the most part. I mean, it's kind of harsh, but whatever. You know,
there's hassles everywhere.
No tickets or anything of that sort?
Yeah.
Ticketed for what?
Actually, objects on sidewalk that I have to pay $233 for. Wow. Objects on sidewalk. It's the most ridiculous, heinous thing I've ever gotten a ticket for in my life.
Objects on the sidewalk.
Not even people? Just
no.
Objects?
Objects.
Well, I guess that comes next year, sitting there. So you have something to say also. We were talking with...
D2. I got a hitchhiking ticket for $160.
From which locality?
Orinda.
And what were the circumstances?
Just hitchhiking. I guess it's illegal.
And were you told it was illegal to hitchhike generally or in that place? Or?
He just said bye in general. I've never gotten a ticket for hitchhiking before. I hitchhiked all the way to Oklahoma and back. It was the first time. So I don't know. I got to go to court for it.
How hard is it to get rides?
But I don't know. Sometimes it's quick. Sometimes you're there like all day.
Where are you from originally?
Grass Valley.
Which is where?
It's up north, kind of like Lake Tahoe, like an hour away.
And any other comments about Berkeley?
The weather's really nice.
Thank you. We've been talking with?
D2.
Thank you, D2.
Oh, it's me, or does that Steve Pledge guy seem to be everywhere at once?
And before we that Steve Pledge guy, so we have a microphone problem. That's one of my difficulties here. Seems like it'd be a bad connection. But as long as we're connected, we are connected. That was the interview or two from Berkeley from last Friday. Berkeley is also the site of a new, apparently a new push to put in a sitting ban in Berkeley. Again, they tried to put one in. They put one in the 90s. I think it was either ruled unconstitutional or it was thrown out by the city council. It was narrowly put in by an initiative, and then it was, I think, modified by the council. And they're trying, I think it was then thrown out again in the next decade, one way or another, either reversed by the voters or by the council. I'm actually looking it up to see if I can find something here. Well, here's something from 1998. Talks about Berkeley City Council wrestled inconclusively. This is in November of 98. With its old nemesis, how to extend a compassionate hand to homeless youth without having Telegraph Avenue become a filthy, drug-using squatter encampment that scares away businesses and residents. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, of course, with its purple prose. Council found itself divided over a much-anticipated comprehensive plan designed to combat drug dealing, this is sound familiar, folks, and aggressive behavior, that's taken straight out of the Coonerty playbook. Coonerty Rotkin playbook here in Santa Cruz, and restore economic vitality to the famous street. And, of course, that's interesting. That's one of the claims that the Santa Cruz Downtown Association, apparently, and the downtown politicians like Coonerty and Rotkin are making, according to Ocean Newman, who I talked to a few days ago, the attorney in Berkeley, who does a thing called the Sidewalk Clinic, where homeless people can go and get help with their tickets. Would that we had a sidewalk clinic here in Santa Cruz. In fact, I've been talking with some potential volunteers for that, and that would be great if we could actually do that. If you're interested in helping with a sidewalk clinic in Santa Cruz, give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and maybe we'll start working on that. That's something, that's one of the, 101 projects that kind of sits around waiting for people to, orphans that need to be essentially adopted by folks who want to do stuff. Council disagreed 13 years ago over the key elements of the 68-part plan assembled by the city staff, of course, in Berkeley at the council's urgent request. 2 weeks ago, to the end, it referred the most controversial parts of the plan to a four-member subcommittee. The deferred items were new ordinances would ban sitting and lying on the sidewalks and Telegraph Avenue and downtown, ban dogs on Telegraph Avenue and downtown. This, again, this is Santa Cruz laws. Ban skateboards on sidewalks. And there was considerable discussion of this. It was apparently sent to committee, and they also wanted to kick down $40,000 for counseling young people. It's always, this is the carrot they tend to throw in up in cities where there's a stronger progressive, so-called progressive, at least members of the city council who don't want to go for this stuff, unlike in Santa Cruz where you have a unanimous vote, including phony posers like Don Lane and Catherine Byers, who claim to be concerned about homeless civil rights but vote for the any restrictive ordinance that Coonerty tends to put up, or that the new, what is it, the Coonerty-Robinson-Bryant majority put up, I guess. That includes Teresa's. Those are the four conservative members of city council. Masquerading, of course, as progressives. You know, they're also progressive, except when it comes to local civil liberties, in which case, you know, hang on to your constitution very tightly, lest it be ripped away from you. And, you know, I'm looking over this article. It's interesting to me because I love the history of this struggle, and it's but I don't know if it's going to mean much to folks who are new to the issue and also isn't very current. So currently, however, there is, I'm looking to see if there's anything more recent online about the sitting ban. Spinning the wheel after lead. How and why to overturn. I'm looking over an interesting how to overturn a sidewalk sitting ban. And this looks like an interesting article. I'll read a little bit of this, since I, although I don't know how much of it is actually going to be available. It looks like it's, yeah, you got to pay $12.50 to actually get to this. Well, for those of us who have $12.50, at some point maybe I'll go into that. It's an interesting discussion of the sitting ban in different cities, Austin, Seattle, Berkeley, Temple, and Tucson, and it's on LexisNexis. So we'll see how that goes at some point. Probably not at the moment. But, well, I mention Ocean Newman because he, this attorney, who's in his 70s now, called me from Berkeley, and he's actually done some good work defending homeless people around sleeping bans, because he's been able to use, I think he's been able to use successfully the so-called necessity defense, the defense that, yeah, what I did was technically illegal, but it was necessary in order to avoid a greater evil. And that's, I think, was a successful defense in the case of the Albany encampment back in 1999, and maybe one of the defenses used in some of the Peace Camp 2010 cases that are coming up in April, and perhaps even sooner. Linda Lemaster is defending herself separately with, actually, Jonathan Gettleman is defending Linda Lemaster, and I'm not sure, I don't know if they're going to use the necessity defense. I think they're more likely probably to use maybe a First Amendment defense, that, you know, that because the people who are sleeping outside the county building and outside City Hall to protest the criminalization of the homeless at night, not only was it a necessity to sleep, it was also a case of First Amendment protected activity in the eyes of many. And it certainly, the city certainly took extraordinary measures to shut down that activity, and measures that would not have been permitted, that weren't permitted in 1996 when then-Mayor Rotkin attempted to do the same thing at City Hall. He attempted to close City Hall at night to homeless protesters and house supporters of homeless protesters who were protesting the criminalization of people at night for sleeping who were homeless. He tried to get a court to enjoin them and to stop them from doing that. The court refused to close City Hall at night. They did agree to make it to order people not to sleep there, but they would not shut down the area for people who wanted to stay awake and vigil. And this time, however, through a slimy backdoor maneuver, the mayor, again, Mayor Rotkin, he was mayor when this was done last fall, he didn't go to the court this time. He just went to the police chief, went to the head of Parks and Rec, went to the city manager, and through a backdoor process, they put up a sign that said, no area closed after, I think it's 10 o'clock at night. And they did the same thing with the library across the street. Although they said closed at 9 o'clock at night. Again, an attempt to deny homeless people the space to sit with their signs, to essentially stay up and vigil, and cramming them out onto a narrow area of the sidewalk. Again, a clear attack on First Amendment rights, which had these people any kind of financial backing or legal muscle, I think, still quite might very well have been successfully challenged, and who knows? There might still be a possibility of a challenge for the damages done to the civil rights of these folks. Again, by this very cynical, very casual, very arbitrary attack on basic First Amendment activity, and it's really a telling symptom of the times in Santa Cruz that this is going down this way. So, speaking of Santa Cruz, okay, let's get back to the inimitable Stephen Plaich, or Steve Plaich, as he calls himself. Steve is a legal worker, an activist, suicide prevention worker, needle exchange guy, former city council candidate, radio broadcaster. Here has been on the show a number of times. He's not in the studio tonight. But he was at the business end of my tape recorder a day or two ago, I think it was. And let's hear what he had to say.
Here, in fact, with Steve Plaich, it's about 10 to 6 on the 13th of March, Sunday the 13th, and a chunky security guard has just told two youths not to sit on this railing because it is illegal to sit down here. I do see a sign that says disabled parking only, but apparently ordinary people are not allowed to sit on this rail here, which probably could be injured by people.
Chunky security guards? Anything like chunky soup?
Simply a factual description of an individual in a security guard outfit.
And of course, we're talking about the area in front of the large downtown CVS store, formerly Long's in Santa Cruz, where there's a railing near the telephone where people frequently sit down, and the guard was marching around telling people not to sit there. And it just leaves a really bad taste in my mouth, this kind of behavior by clowns in uniforms with this kind of authority.
Who has been walking around the building.
He could be less than complimentary about your physique, too, if he chose to be.
Very true. Not so much less than complimentary. Chunky is not necessarily uncomplimentary.
But chunky soup?
Exactly. Chunky
it's
soup.
A better soup.
Chunky is better.
Yeah.
In fact, in this case, chunky is excellent. I would say I'm probably chunkier than the secure. Well, hard to say. He's shorter than I am, so it shows more on him. Anyway, I was surprised to learn that it is they are now enforcing the no sitting on this railing, which is a railing about 2 inches high, which actually, I guess, it guards certain squashed plants that are back here. Maybe that's it, trying to protect the plants. What do you think, Plaich?
We're saving the planet.
The plant
6 inches at a time.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, it's a quick report here from the CBS on a rainy Sunday afternoon. But now it's a sunny Wednesday afternoon on Pacific Avenue. The Borders has a closing store with everything on sale. And there's nary a street vendor, musician, or homeless person in the three blocks between Soquel and Zoccoli's, or is it two blocks? How'd it go?
Hello.
Actually, someone is just packing up there, and David is doing some performing here. Let's get the word. David, any reports from the street? No? We're out here on the streets, so it's about 4 o'clock, talking with
Michelle Blade.
Michelle, you've just spent actually 4 hours doing some jewelry display in hopes of donation?
Yes.
And how's the business today?
Business is okay today. You know, there's a farmer's market going on. I made about $60.
Not bad. $15 an hour.
Yeah.
Rough $20 an hour for 3 hours, but it's 4 o'clock. If you're here since noon, that would be 4 hours. And you say that cop police once told a person sitting next to you to stand up, drove by 3 times, but otherwise didn't hassle you?
Yeah, today was the best day I've had in a while.
And how frequently have you been out here?
Every day.
It should be said that while she may be making that money in gross profit, she has to pay for her materials, she has to spend the time making her jewelry, and then she has to spend the time displaying it and hoping to sell it or get a donation for it.
And would you say, let's say, yesterday or the day before, were there any other further hassles?
Oh, yeah. Yesterday, I was probably asked to leave about 4 or 5 times. And also, just yesterday, they put up a bench right in front of the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company because that was one of the only places you can set up your jewelry. It was a really good spot. And so I believe that the Downtown Association decided to put a bench there so that people wouldn't be able to sit up there anymore.
Even though it's the taxpayers who would be paying for the bench, the Parks and Rec who orders it, and the Public Works, perhaps, I'm not sure if they set it up, but it's a city agency, so one wonders what the merchants are doing, if in fact you're right, essentially monopolizing more of the public space.
Yes, I mean, it's not a wavy thing. It's a completely positive thing, exactly what they're doing with that bench. Everybody noticed it, and hospitality people were actually waiting for people to set up there hours after it was set up. So it was obvious that it was an attempt to get rid of people selling their stuff.
And so you said that yesterday you did have some problems with police, or that you noticed them more. What was that about?
One of the ladies, there's this new police officer. I believe she's new. She has black hair. She wears sunglasses. She tends to like to harass a lot of the homeless people and a lot of the street merchants. She, unlike most cops, she doesn't really follow the rules. She likes to come up to people and tell them really rude things. Like, she told me that I have too many bags, and that's the reason why I couldn't set up, which isn't a rule at all. I don't think the amount of bags you own bans you from being downtown, but, you know, she likes to make rules up just to kick you out. Some people just like to make other people miserable.
You don't remember her name, I should.
No, I don't remember her name, but she's the only lady cop that works downtown.
And how many times did she have any connection with you yesterday?
3 times.
And on the first one of the occasions, she commented on your bags. Did she say anything else?
No, she just kept reminding me that, you know, like, oh, you've been set up here too long. Even though I hadn't been set up there for the maximum amount of time, they like to cut your time shorter than the rules are. I think it's just a way to try to get you out, you know. They just like to kind of drain you because you can't really say, it's a cop's word against yours. They like to drain you as much as they can, try to get you to stop coming altogether.
What was your response to her yesterday? What did you do?
I just said thank you, and I told her I would leave right away, and I packed up and left. I don't want to cause problems with them, because if you say anything out of line with them, even something like that's not fair or that's not true, they will make your life miserable for weeks.
Have you had that experience yourself? Or
many times.
Here in Santa Cruz?
Many times.
Last time that happened was?
That happened about 2 months ago. A cop came up to me and told me I had been set up for 2 hours, although I'd only been set up for 15 minutes in front of Borders. And I had proof. I actually had a hotel checkout saying that I had checked out only 25 minutes before that. So I told him, listen, I haven't been here for 2 hours. And he started writing me a ticket because I was there for over an hour, although I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And when I told him that it wasn't true, he called me a liar and told me that I should be quiet, otherwise I can get arrested for it. And they actually called backup. And there was actually a pretty huge scene. A lot of people started protesting against the cops for how they were treating me.
And did you eventually get a ticket, or?
Oh, yeah, I got a ticket, and then I filed a complaint against the cop, but, you know.
His name was?
And you know what, I don't even remember that.
It wasn't Winston, by any chance.
Actually, I think it is Winston, yeah. He's a
short cop.
Short cop, bald.
Bald. I don't think Winston's bald, but
no. Okay. Well, it's a bald cop.
So, What happened when you went to court, or did you go to court?
I haven't gone to court yet. I'm actually waiting for the complaint forms right now. They're pretty, I don't think they sent them, and I think I'm going to have to call them again to ask for the complaint forms for a second time. From what I've heard from other people, when you ask for complaint forms, it takes a couple times for them to actually send them because they really don't want complaints on the cops.
Who did you talk to get a complaint form?
I called the Santa Cruz Police Department. I also called the chief of police. He's the one that forwarded me to that specific line.
And how many times have you spoken to them?
3 times.
And when was the last, when did you first speak to them?
About 2 months ago.
And when was the most recent time you spoke to them?
About a month and a half ago.
And you still haven't received any forms?
No.
You gave them an address?
Yes, in San Jose.
And you've been checking that address?
Yes.
Well, maybe you're just too young to get those forms. Maybe you need your father to send a letter.
My father died, so I don't think that's going to happen.
Yes. And how old are you?
I'm 21.
So you're old enough to drink, but not enough to get forms from the police department,
are you? Yeah, it seems so.
Wow. And we've been talking with...
Michelle Blade.
Thanks, Michelle. Anything you want to add for your potential fans out there?
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Do you have something additional to say about police and the hosts generally?
Oh, yeah. What I wanted to mention was that almost all the hospitality, first alarm people, and police officers are really nice people, and they're very considerate of people out here on the street. And I can tell that they really don't want to enforce these laws. There's only a handful of people who actually cause really a problem. Actually, even some hospitality people have told some of the people who don't cause problems, the street people, that as long as nobody ask them for their spot, they won't move them. So, you know, they've made special exceptions to people who abide by the rules, and they're very respectful of especially people who come here often. And you just need to treat them with respect to be treated back with respect. There's only a few that, you know, will make your life a living hell for no reason.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, the problem is that those few can have a disproportionate impact and are not controlled either by their sergeants or by the good police chief, Kevin Vogel, who I like personally, by the way. I've known him for decades, but I wouldn't say that we're drinking buddies. Anyway, you're tuned to freakradio.org, and unfortunately we aren't broadcasting at 101.1 because of transmitter problems, but hopefully that will be remedied sometime in the next 5 years. That's a little morbid. Let's just say a little negative. Hopefully in the next week we can get some get back on the air. On Sunday I expect to have Joanne Cull, a writer for Street Roots newspaper, who writes up in Portland, Oregon. Street Roots is a twice monthly homeless paper, probably one of the best papers in the country now. They cover Oregon and they cover Portland, and they've been going for about 13 years now, and she was going to be on the air a couple weeks ago, but she got sick. But I talked to her today, and she's willing to jump on the bandwagon and get back on the air, and hopefully she will. And that's going to be happening again at 10 o'clock on Sunday coming up, assuming that I don't freak out and think we're not on the air as I did today. Came into the studio and found essentially we weren't broadcasting, contacted Uncle Dennis, who will be coming in tonight, and he'll be doing his show or putting on something for his show. And I got the misimpression that nothing was happening here, but actually we are. I'm presumably going out. Otherwise, I'm having a fine time talking to this piece of foam rubber microphone, which makes me look pretty silly if that's the case. Anyway, let's hear another tune. We were listening before to Kodachrome. Let's hear Viper Mad Rag, shall we, and see if that pleases at all. That would be cool if it does.
Just a viper man.
And that was, as I said before, Viper Mad Rag, Ragged Time, Eli Charleston, in a disc that came out in 2005, but I bought it a couple weeks ago, so call me old-fashioned. I like that music, and I found him on the streets strumming away. Just got our first phone call from Bob LaMonica, who informed us, of course, which we knew already, that we aren't on the air, but I told him, we are on the stream, and it appears we are on the stream, but I'm not sure. I'm hoping we are. Maybe I'll get some word from some of you listeners out there one way or the other as to whether that's happening. It would be pretty depressing if it's not. On the other hand, I could go home and go to sleep. Maybe that would be a good idea, or have dinner or something like that. So, I mentioned before that Julia Vinograd, who's a Berkeley poet who I have had on the air and actually did have on the air on Sunday, reading a couple of her poems as we sat in an outdoor cafe. She's one of my favorite poets, and she's got a book that she put out, which I'm going to read a poem or two from. So without further ado, well, actually, let's have a little further ado, and let's see who we got here. I think that's probably Uncle Bob LaMonica. Hi there, you're not on the air, but you're on the stream of Free Radio. Hello? Hello? Oh, I hope you're on the stream, but perhaps you're not. Can you hear me? Hang on a second. Hi, can you hear me? Okay, I'm having some trouble apparently because I can hear you when I talk to you, but unfortunately nobody out there can hear you, and I'm having some difficulty with the lines. Maybe I can try you, if you want to call in on the other line. Unless you want to, I can just convey what your thoughts are, if you'd like. Anyway, we're having some studio problems here. Let's see here. It's 469-3119. That's, we'll try if we can hear you there. Hang on. Okay. So, I can hear the ting-a-ling-a-ling in the studio. The question is, can we actually do it on the air? And we'll see. Hi, we hope you can hear us on Free Radio.
Is it coming through?
You are coming through there, Bob.
Look at that.
So welcome to Free Radio. I know that often you call on Sundays, and good to have you on this Thursday evening.
Well, cool, Robert. I wanted to talk to you a bit.
Okay.
And first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on a successful Huff meeting. I think that's my second Huff meeting in a while.
Huh.
But I think it was pretty cool.
Well, we had your participation and that of about five or six other people. And for those who are interested, the next one will be at the Sub Rosa, 10:30 on Wednesday morning at, I guess it's is it Sycamore and Pacific? I don't know the name of that street. They're all named after trees, but it's one street past Laurel, kind of a block up from the Saturn Cafe. The Sub Rosa Cafe is it's a little cafe where you can get very inexpensive coffee, and there's some interesting literature. They have a little, and they have an anarchist library there that's quite extensive.
So you're moving next week.
Yeah, we're planning to, yeah. I'll be putting that out, of course. Usually I put out an agenda the day before, but we decided that we would move to Sub Rosa because it's downtown, more centrally located, and we're hoping that they're now having, they've assured us repeatedly they will be open at 10:30. We used to meet there, but then they stopped being open and we had a problem.
I wanted to talk to you about the ACLU Santa Cruz chapter.
Ah, that's a meeting coming up on Tuesday?
Tuesday the 22nd, and I don't know whether there will be any publicity at all, the way these folks act.
7 p.m. at Loudon Nelson?
Room 1. 7 p.m. Tuesday, upcoming, room 1. First meeting in what appears to be about 11 months.
Huh. You know, it's interesting you should say it's room 1 because all their previous meetings, their general meetings, have been in room 3, I believe, which is the large kind of assembly room, you know, where you got into projectors and screens and, you know, a little kitchen off to the side. So apparently they are of somewhat diminished numbers at the present time.
Well, I think they want to keep it that way. I think, as I've said prior, they want to put their lipstick on the pig. I really wonder whether this meeting, which is open to the public, is going to be publicized at all. I don't know whether it came out in good times. It should have. Should have come out in the weekly. And when City on the Hill Press comes out, it should come out.
I don't know.
If they're going to act according to basic principles of openness.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Well, tell us about your experience with this local ACLU. I've often denounced them, of course, on the radio and talked a bit about Huff's attempts to get some kind of acknowledgement around the sleeping ban, opposition to the sleeping ban and so forth, and other anti-homeless laws. And in fact, Bernard Klitzner put a lot of energy when he was a Huff member into trying to communicate with Don Zimmerman and other people in ACLU, and he was able to communicate, but it wasn't very successful, and they never actually formally considered the issues that I think are local civil liberties issues. And you became interested in this how recently?
Well, I became interested in it, and then it was a trigger for a bunch of stuff with the Westmoods incident. When the ACLU did not stand up, when Westmoods is singled out as the only participant.
In the DIY last night parade.
DIY 2010, and nary a ripple.
Right.
Out of the ACLU.
It should be said again, for those who don't know, that in 2009, New Year's Eve, there was a large, as there had been for the previous 4 or 5 years, a parade led by no one in particular, but just sort of generated as a community event involving a lot of kids and a lot of adults and a very kind of mellow, happy parade. And it didn't have a permit and hadn't had a permit for any time previous. And it, there were no police incidents except that Westmoods and two other people got citations, and Modes was actually prosecuted in court for walking in a parade without a permit.
And he did 30 hours.
And he was convicted in the absurd court of Olmquist.
Let's bring this up now. They branded him as the organizer, but they couldn't get him legally as the organizer, so they get him through a kangaroo process as a participant.
Right, walking in a parade.
Nobody stands up. Nobody stands up at the ACLU of Santa Cruz County, which claims on their website defending the Bill of Rights in Santa Cruz County.
Yeah, right.
You know, equal protection under the law.
Uh-huh.
Nobody stands up for that transgression.
So that's what really first, you know, so kicked off your concern about them.
It was for me I'll use an Italian word. It was my risorgimento, which means resurgence. Running into Westmoods by pure accident, mid-November, and I know I read it in August, but I blew it off. You know, this guy's convicted as the only participant within the Sentinel. I, for one reason or another. But when I met Modes, and then the following day, Zach Friend and Rick Martinez happened to be on Talk About.
And Martinez is a lieutenant, and Friend is a sort of the, I call him the police department's little Goebbels. He's
and
a PR guy.
I called
PR
them and
guy.
Asked about it, and they were essentially dancing around it. I said, you know, there were consul people at the parade that he was arrested in. Why didn't you go after them? Well, he says, if you want, you can call our tip line, and, you know, we'll try to be more effective next time. You know, snide stuff. I mean, I like one-liners too, but right, you know, they didn't deal with the obvious indiscretion here. You can't get the guy as the organizer, so you get him as the only participant in a parade of 800 with 1,000. And I come back to the ACLU, Robert, which wasn't there. Nobody stood up.
Well, some of us stood up, but we weren't
well, I mean,
lawyers.
Nobody from the ACLU stood up.
Right, right.
A lot of people stood up.
Right. It should also be said that Mose was a particularly vulnerable person because 2 years before, in a what I call a near police riot created at the farmers market area in parking lot number 4, where there was a regular drum circle, police provoked essentially a very angry response from a lot of people by going after a Food Not Bombs volunteer. And Modes was, you know, doing a sort of demonstration drumming right next to Sergeant Harms, and was then brutalized and hauled away by the police and, you know, essentially dragged through court for about a year and a half. And finally, because he became tired of the whole thing, he took what essentially was a kind of a plea bargain, which I always think is a mistake. And this new charge of walking in a parade was going to be used possibly to send him to jail for a year on essentially a violation of the plea bargain. And that was really the threat they were hanging over his head last year with this charge. That's why it was particularly, in my mind, vicious what was going on, and particularly depressing that Judge Almquist, although I understand Almquist has made some good decisions somewhere along the line, but every time I'm in his court, it looks horrible. I mean, I haven't been tried in his court, but I've seen him convict Becky Johnson for singing.
I want to bring that up, too.
Yeah, singing a homeless song.
I want to bring up your Nazi salute and a couple other ones. On the Moats trip, Robert, after the May Day activity on Pacific Avenue,
right.
Moats became the fall guy.
And the May Day activity, of course, was a series of broken windows on May 1st.
He was the proprietor of the den of political iniquity called Sub Rosa.
Which is where we'll be having our meeting.
He was branded in the media as being the influencer.
So yeah.
The town, my mind is the town needed a fall guy, and it was Wes Moats for 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And any way you cut it with this parade, 1,000 people, 800 people, including consul people, and one guy is singled out and branded as the sole participant, and has to do 30 hours community service, and has that mark. You know, but it goes back. I mean, the ACLU in this town, going back, in my mind, 24 years, has never stood up for anything other than photo ops and backslapping. I think it's a disgrace. And I know you've pointed this out over the years. I know you've been after the ACLU for 20 years. But we're talking here dereliction of duty and subversion of purpose. If there's a purpose at the ACLU, they claim on their website defending the Bill of Rights in Santa Cruz County. That's the claim. Well, what about this Modes trip? You know, they can say whatever they want. It's outside their purview. But come on. You know, at what point do you stand up for what you claim to be about?
Well, it's clear that the ACLU in other jurisdictions are significantly more active. Like in Los Angeles, they challenged the sitting ban and the sleeping ban successfully in the Jones decision, which became the Jones settlement. In Fresno, they were on board with the settlement that got $2.3 million out of the city for their seizure of homeless property using a system that Santa Cruz still uses. Santa Cruz still seizes homeless property and does not keep it. It destroys it in the Poganip. That's been done by Ranger Wallace. I understand he's now no longer with us, or it's unclear whether he's with us or not. But that's, you know, their policy. The ACLU hasn't taken any action on this. You know, full disclosure, the ACLU has done a few things on rare occasions. In 1994, it did defend some of the people arrested en masse in the sitting ban demonstrations of May 1994.
Didn't stand up for Catherine Gardner in 1994.
And it didn't stand up for Linda Edwards, who was trying to defend herself. She was a homeless activist who was trying.
Didn't stand up for you, and I'd said this when you did it, that Nazi salute may have been callous, idiotic, impish, but it wasn't disrupting a meeting.
No, it didn't disrupt the meeting.
The ACLU, which could have issued a position statement to the press, contrary to the city arresting you and charging you with disrupting a meeting.
And wasting a lot of money.
Oh, what, $150K by now?
Yeah, it's going up.
And there's nary a ripple once again. Nothing rises to the point where this group locally will touch it. Not even with, what is it, Edwin's 11-foot pole, right? The proverbial 11-foot pole. No, they won't touch anything.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Zimmerman, an attorney who joined the ACLU for a short period of time, I think it was relatively short, he did attempt and did get the ACLU to oppose a part of Coonerty's sidewalk, not sidewalk, but parking lot panic law, as I called it, the law that we now have. The ACLU was not successful. But they did make one attempt in 2007 to say, mainly under his leadership, and he's no longer doing that. I don't think. I think he spends a lot of his time overseas, and he hasn't been involved for at least a year. And the ACLU, as you point out, hasn't been involved. But they asked that the law that says you can't read a book in your car in a public parking lot. You can't stand and talk with a friend in a public parking lot in Santa Cruz. You can't change your baby's diapers in a car in a public park. All this is illegal now, thanks to Mayor Ryan Coonerty, who was given the Hammer of Justice Award by the same ACLU.
Well, that's how it works. that's how you cover up a cowardice, all right? That's how it's done, not just by the ACLU of Santa Cruz chapter. They're just practicing that tactic. You know, Pacific Avenue, and I haven't been, I've been involved really politically for about 10 years, but there was considerably more laxity on Pacific Avenue for political freedom of speech, and now there are these zones. And two incidents that you know very well, Becky Johnson and Steve Argue. Becky Johnson singing political songs, and we need to say this, political songs
on
Pacific Avenue. And in the same spot that Becky served, I think, 35 years for that grievousness. 35 hours of community service, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
On that same
spot, for 20 minutes of singing, right.
Yeah, I saw a Beatles quartet sing. Oh, by the time we got there, they had been singing. We saw them for three or four songs, and they were singing when we left. Now, political freedom of speech, you're supposed to give some slack to it. The other one is Steve Argue. You know, in the double standard. I've seen the Democratic Party, the milquetoast Democratic Party, on the same spot all afternoon. Steve Argue, after an hour, the police say, your time is up, Mr. Argue, and he says, you got to move. And he says, no, I don't think so. They arrest him.
Right, under the Rotkin-Matthews move-along law. That is a very unique law to Santa Cruz, and it was not opposed by the ACLU that I'm aware of.
I'm saying, once again, the Democratic Party will be in the same spot all afternoon, nary a ripple.
Mm-hmm.
But when it is controversial, well, then we have to enforce the absolute letter of the law. Rather than give it additional leeway because it's political freedom of speech, which is what should be done in Santa Cruz, California. So to me, the hypocrisy with this group is so deep and has been going on for so long that I almost am coming back to a more strident point of view, which is that the entire board of directors should resign. Now, I'm not saying it's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
but when you go back to 94 and 87, 94, Catherine Gardner is paid $40K to sit at home, under allegations that she'd been snorting coke, she was an assistant DA, overlapping the election, right, for DA with Ed Fry. After the election, they fire her. She files for reinstatement, and there's a minor publicity explosion. The ACLU doesn't do anything.
And this is under the kind of the führership of Art Danner.
That's right.
The
ACLU
does
nothing. Uh-huh. And it's procedurally exonerated about a year later by Resolution 11495 on a 4-1 vote with Marty Wormhout dissenting.
Mm-hmm.
No mention of the election context. During that incident, the Sentinel ran an editorial condemning Ed Fry, sour grapes, they said. Ed Fry wanted to subpoena the time cards, which I think would have been pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
The Sentinel said sour grapes. Fry is claiming the election was tainted.
Fry ran against Art Danner.
Right. Uh-huh. So this is the spin. And the ACLU is either in lockstep with it, or in some cases they actively denounce people that dare to speak out against their cowardice.
Or they elevate people who are, you know, who should be called for their violations of civil liberties. I mean, you know, Coonerty is a lawyer. I don't know if he's licensed in California. I think he's licensed back east. But he teaches constitutional law, I think, at both Cabrillo and UCSC. And I was told by one of the copy shops that he actually uses the, you know, the mock Nazi salute case that you referred to, where I was, where I, you know, they've spent so much money, you know, trying to,
and they're going
to
lose,
fight the rules that I want to see change to allow people to engage in dissenting gestures, dissenting words, provided they don't disrupt the actual council process.
And they have ghettoized oral communications, as you've said.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is this big downhill turn in this town where everything is being turned off. The bigots of freedom of speech.
Well, that's sort of, you know, and of course, in a way, that parallels what's going on nationwide with, you know, Obama, Guantanamo, unlawful enemy combatants. I guess he calls them now unprivileged enemy belligerents, or has some new fancy phraseology he uses. But, you know, it is essentially the abrogation of at least even, you know, on the surface, what the Constitution says the rights people should have, even though for poor people, those rights have not really been enforced really ever in any meaningful way. Unless you have money, you don't get rights often, but in some cases you do. But now, even the appearance of those rights seems to be thrown out the window nationally and indeed locally.
Local application of values. I am naive enough to be shocked. I want to bring up one more incident and then invite whoever might be listening who is concerned with civil rights in Santa Cruz to come to the meeting Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, Loudoun Nelson Center, Room 1. I want to talk about Sandra Larson a little bit. 1987. She is the victim of the district attorney's bodily injury car wreck. She ends up in the hospital.
That's when Art Danner plowed into her car. And
front-end fender bender. And the only reason we know that is because Marv Cohen got the San Jose Mercury News to write a story after finding out that the Sentinel wasn't going to touch it.
And she got she was suddenly drug and alcohol tested, but he wasn't, even though he'd had two
exactly
martinis.
Right. Yeah. He had a gin and tonic in part of a second. Now at what point do we stand up? At what point do we say we will not be intimidated? At what point do we say this is wrong? At what point is the ACLU Santa Cruz chapter culpable? If for no other reason than their complicit silence. They want the limelight. They take the limelight. They give themselves these awards. They have their photo ops. They're there for a purpose, as far as I can see, which is to deflect, to say that these things do not rise to the occasion of the ACLU, when in fact they do, if it means anything. Sandra Larson was not equally protected under the law. How dare we allow that to go down? And I don't care whether it was 24 years ago or 24 days ago. It was wrong. Mm-hmm. And this community has yet to rise to that occasion where it can admit that it was wrong.
And you're going to be at least raising the issue before, I don't know, a scattered number of ACLU members who happen to show up at this meeting.
As I said, if they do no publicity, which is the way it looks, their website is still down, my message will become more strident.
Well, I know that that's also the day when Project Connect is happening, and I'll be talking about that. That's the all-day homeless event that we're going to be doing some tabling at the Civic Auditorium, and that'll be talking about. But also this weekend there's going to be we'll be protesting in the rain, if the weather reports are accurate, in order to support Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, as well as to end the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the war against the poor in Santa Cruz. And I guess, I think you're likely to show up at that event, too.
I'm going to be a speaker.
You're going to be speaking at that event, yeah.
Which I'm very grateful. You're going to be a speaker.
Me too, yeah. And I guess
just say, in that context, and I agree with you,
mm-hmm.
These are outrages. The war in Iraq. The only reason that Americans went into harm's way in Iraq was the allegations of weapons of mass destruction. It was a lie then, and it's a lie now.
Oh yeah, I mean the irony is that the Democrats
knew it then.
What's that?
They knew it then.
And the Democrats were screaming about it, you know, when they weren't in power. But once, of course, they got in power, they don't have shit to do about it, and they don't hold the people accountable who they're supposed to hold, and they continue the same policies. You know, I mean, it's depressing to say the least.
Robert, I'll see you Saturday.
All right, 11 o'clock is the sign making
I'll be there.
Party, and I invite everyone to show up at the town clock, wear your rubbers, and bring an umbrella.
And any and all that believe that civil rights should be represented in Santa Cruz, California, come to the meeting Tuesday night, 7 o'clock, Loudoun Nelson Center.
Room 1. And thank you, Bob, and you might want to post a story about it on Indy Bay, and that might draw a few more people to come.
On the events part?
Or as a story. You could do it as an event, and you can do both. You can do a little thing in the calendar. That's for those
I don't want to sound. I don't want to come on too upstagey or whatever, which is why I haven't, Robert. I thought that they would do minimal publicity, like any normal group does.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen anything yet,
scam.
Let me put it that way.
As I said, if they do no publicity, or virtually none, before the event, my speech will become much more strident, and I had come to the point where I was going to mellow it out.
Well,
metamorphosis of local mission is central purpose. Well, that might not end up being my call to action.
We'll hear you on Tuesday. I think I'll probably be there, too, although, again, that's also city council days. Everything is converging at that time. It's kind of difficult to – but then, again, the city council isn't going to be listening to you, so why bother to pay much attention to them, except, of course, that they make the rules that we tend to suffer under, and they pay the police that enforce those rules.
I think we saw New Year's Eve last, DIY 2011, a shift. I think that this town, 2011, can return, you know, take back Santa Cruz, give back Santa Cruz, return it to some degree of respectability with the idealistic claims that it has. If you can't allow for freedom of speech to be given additional laxity, then everything is meaningless and a joke. And to me, the Westmode's arrest and conviction as the sole participant ought to be enough for people to say, this is wrong, I'm not afraid, it's time to stand up. 200 people were there.
Well, let's see,
and that was under constant threats of reprisal from the police and from city government.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that, at least so far, as I mentioned to you at the meeting we had at the Huff meeting on Wednesday, there haven't been any tickets that I've heard of, but then again, perhaps I haven't heard of them yet. I know that I marched in that parade, and as far as I know, I don't think they had a permit, but I haven't gotten a ticket yet, but you never can tell. Sometimes these tickets appear pretty late in the game, so who knows what they're going to do.
Yeah, well, we'll keep our
keep watching
mailboxes peeled for a certified letter from whoever.
Yeah, from the shitty attorney.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey.
My sense is if they were to do that, it would come back to them.
I don't think they
would look like animals.
I think that last year they did it by February. They gave out three citations, Modes, Whitney Wilds, and Curtis Relliford, the fellow who did all the transporting of supplies to New Orleans, and you know, the African-American guy. Anyway, I'll talk to you more later.
You take it easy, Robert.
Thank you, Bob. And perhaps we'll see you Tuesday, 7 o'clock, Loudoun Nelson Center, Room 1 at the ACLU meeting.
Thank you, and all the best for you.
All right, man.
See ya.
And again, remember, Saturday at 1 o'clock, actually, sorry, at 11 o'clock in the morning, the sign party at the town clock, and then at 12 o'clock, a series of speakers. Yours truly, Steve Plaich, a number of other folks, I think Steve Argue. We're going to be talking about, it's, of course, the anniversary of the U.S. Invasion of Iraq and its continued occupation of Iraq. I should also say that I just looked online, and the UN has okayed all necessary measures, no-fly zone, to protect Libyans. I have really mixed feelings about this. Here's the story. The UN Security Council on Thursday authorized all necessary measures, including airstrikes by air and sea, to protect civilians from attacks by Muammar Gaddafi's forces. The no-fly zone resolution passed 10-0 with 5 abstentions, including Russia and China, which have veto power, and Germany, India, and Brazil. It was unclear when the West would take action. President Barack Obama spoke with French President Nicolas Sarkozy and British Prime Minister David Cameron on Thursday night. The White House said the three agreed Libya must immediately comply with all the terms of the UN resolution. The resolution establishes a ban on all flights in the airspace of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya, while excluding an occupation force. It also calls for freezing the assets of the Libyan National Oil Corporation and the Central Bank because of links with Gaddafi. A British lawmaker said British forces could be mobilized as early as Thursday night. U.S. officials speaking after a closed-door briefing in Congress said they expected to ground The attempt to ground Gaddafi's air force could begin by Sunday or Monday, would probably involve jet fighters, bombers, and surveillance aircraft. Cameron called a cabinet meeting for Friday and also make a statement to Parliament on Libya. A spokeswoman said the UN resolution reflected the past week's swift reversal of the situation in Libya, where once confident rebels are now in danger of being obliterated by an overwhelming pro-Gaddafi force using rockets, artillery, tanks, warplanes. That force has advanced along the Mediterranean coast, aiming to capture the rebel-held eastern half of Libya. However, after the vote, Libyan Deputy Foreign Minister Khalid Kaim in Tripoli took a conciliatory tone, offering to negotiate a ceasefire with the rebels. He welcomed the Security Council's endorsement of the territorial unity of Libya and concern for its citizens, but called on the world not to allow them to receive weapons, because if any countries do that, they'll be inviting Libyans to kill each other. Of course, considering that he's representing a government that is butchering its citizens, it's a kind of a sort of a hypocritical thing to say. You have to consider what he's doing at the same time as he calls for it. French Foreign Minister Alain Jupp flew to New York Thursday to press the case for speedy Security Council approval. The world is living one of its great revolutions that changes the course of history, Jupp told the Security Council just before the vote. Of course, we have to note that they aren't taking any military action against Saudi Arabia, which is sending troops into Bahrain. And I'm not sure how many people are being shot down there, but it's not looking good, according to Al Jazeera. Thousands of anti-Qaddafi protesters in Benghazi watched the UN proceeding on an outdoor TV projector and celebrated the vote by firing guns in the air, setting off fireworks and waving flags from the monarchy era and celebration, Al Jazeera TV showed. Earlier, French Prime Minister François Fillon said on France 2 TV that time is of the essence. France would support military action within a matter of hours if the Security Council approves the resolution. Military action could come, example, by providing the use of their air bases. Italy said it would make its military bases available to enforce the no-fly zone. Canada will contribute 6 CF-18 fighters to help enforce a Libyan no-fly zone. German Foreign Minister Guido Vettevel said his troops will not take part, but he still believes Gaddafi must stop the war against his own people. The U.S. would likely use bombers, fighter planes, including F-16s, F-15s, F-22s, strike ground targets. And there, of course, is what was said some days ago by, Gates, I believe, Secretary of War, or they like to call it defense in the United States, who said that if you're going to engage in a no-fly zone, that essentially is an attack on Libya. It is an attack on, you know, you have to drop bombs, you have to bomb all the artillery places, and of course, and all the anti-aircraft places, bomb the airfields. And since most of Libyan population centers are along the coast, there's always the Libyan Navy to consider, which is apparently being used as well to shell people, and the Libyan Qaddafi forces have tanks and artillery and all kinds of weaponry, which the other side does not have so much of, although there is a claim by Fisk of the, I believe he's of the Independent, the UK Independent, that the U.S. has secretly been funding weaponry through Saudi Arabia to arm the rebels. You know, it's a difficult issue for me because I've got a number of mixed concerns. Well, I mean, one is, of course, obviously, you have a brutal dictator who's crushing people, like Saddam Hussein, you know, crushing people. But then you have a very self-involved, self-interested Western powers who want to intervene for their own purposes. OIL, oil. And the question arises as to what's really going on here. Initially, my sentiments were entirely for a non-intervention in that situation. But then when you start to hear people, Libyans themselves, call for intervention, it becomes another issue. The non-intervention position has been put forward by antiwar.org somewhat. And it's kind of ironic at the same time as they're pushing for the officials in the United States are pushing for an intervention and bombing of Libya. The House has nixed a bid for Afghan withdrawal. A 93-321 House vote today ended the Kucinich-Jones-Ron Paul resolution calling for an end to the nearly decade-long war in Afghanistan. The vote saw a massive majority of Republicans and a narrowing majority of Democrats approving the continuation of the conflict. The vote was surely a contentious one, and that was made all the more clear when General David Petraeus took it upon himself to directly insert himself into the political debate, insisting the resolution would give victory to Osama bin Laden. But in the end, the House of Representatives voted, as was expected, hugely in favor of the war. It was slightly closer than the 2010 version, yet it cannot be ignored that over 75% of the representatives, quote-unquote, in the House of Representatives and the Congress, still support the war, when a solid 64% of American voters were shown in the most recent poll to be firmly against the Afghan war. With the high-profile Republicans like Governor Halley Barbour openly questioning the wisdom of the war, it seems clear that House Republicans' failure to muster more than 8 votes is a sign that they're already falling out of touch with the wishes of the public, which just months ago put them back in the majority. I'm not sure what they mean by 8 votes. Because it sounds like a majority of the Republicans, overwhelming majority, voted for this resolution. But again, that's the defeat that we have to fight. The crackdown in Bahrain and arrests followed the deadly crackdown in Bahrain. That's a little country next to Saudi Arabia where the 5th U.S. fleet is based. And here's the story at Al Jazeera. Several opposition leaders and activists have been arrested in Bahrain following a violent crackdown on anti-government protests in the Gulf Kingdom. State television said leaders of the civil strife have been arrested for communicating with foreign countries inciting murder and destruction of property. Among those who were arrested was Hassan Mushaima, who had returned last month from self-imposed exile in the United Kingdom after Bahraini authorities dropped charges against him, and Ibrahim Sharif, head of the Awad Political Society, a secular group composing mostly Sunni members. There's a Shiite issue of the Sunni oppression of Shiites, as is the case in neighboring Saudi Arabia. People are standing up anyway, and that is the encouraging thing. Lots of stuff going on. But all dispensers of the two green wave lines that have been fighting without any members said that the reason they're banning them is that the dispensaries fly in the face of federal law. You know, Jews are supposed to wear stars in the marijuana patients are supposed to wear big M's and they're not allowed to have their medicine, right? Residents don't want the establishments. We don't want them Negroes in our neighborhood. And the potential for increased crime and abuse by children. That's the children again. Patients can either grow their own marijuana or obtain it at other dispensaries. It's kind of hard if having some problem with this mic. My apologies, folks. I hope that we're okay with this now. It goes into effect in early May. Debate began a year ago when a Scotts Valley resident actually tried to open a dispensary, Scott Gates, according to this story. And He applied before the council for the fourth time, and he was denied an application for a business license. So now they're going to try to circumvent that whole thing by banning all dispensaries. You know, don't need no marijuana people, and we don't want no Jews in our neighbor. We don't want no Negroes. You know, that sort of thing. I don't go for that. I think it's the same kind of discriminatory attitude and the same kind of medieval approach, which has nothing to do with any factual stats on crime or anything else. If you look at the so-called crime, probably one of the safer areas in Santa Cruz is, you know, around Harvey West, where there's been no indications of crime around the two dispensaries that I've heard of. Not that I'm a big fan of either of these dispensaries for other reasons, but still, the argument is preposterous. Ahead of the unanimous vote at the Scotts Valley City Council last night banning medical marijuana dispensaries, several people addressed the council, most opposing the ban. Among them were Gates, the guy who tried to open the marijuana dispensary, who restated comments he made at other council meetings about the need for a local dispensary for those unable to travel elsewhere, the high cost of security, the high level of security would provide, and how he planned to donate to area health-related nonprofits. He and Chris Coulter of Americans for Safe Access, a group that advocates for medical cannabis, also criticized Councilwoman Donna Lind for sending out an email ahead of the public hearing soliciting comments from residents with wording they said that clearly showed a bias. Information staff received ahead of Wednesday's meeting included a 2009 report from the California Police Chiefs Association, which detailed how cooperatives operate around the state and their effects on the communities where they operate. I have not read this, and it could be an interesting report. According to that report, law enforcement officials from Mendocino and San Diego counties have reported armed robberies at both the dispensaries and patients' homes, questionable practices by physicians and health risks from fertilizers, and mold accumulation in grow houses. And I don't deny that that may be true. My question would be, how does that compare with the robberies, let's say, of the 7-Elevens down the street? It's a comparative kind of crime that you're interested in. Otherwise, you're using selective figures to essentially terrorize people into accepting an ideology which has been long discredited in Santa Cruz, but somehow still seems to hold sway. It's amazing. Gates and his supporters dismissed the safety concerns, saying that far more robberies and criminal activities occur at liquor stores and convenience stores and dispensaries, which, of course, is what I just said. I haven't got the stats on that, but that's my impression. You don't really hear about marijuana. I've never heard about marijuana dispensary in Santa Cruz being robbed, but I've heard about 7-Elevens and being robbed and banks being robbed with some regularity. But, you know, are we pulling the licenses? I probably should pull the licenses on the banks. They're unsafe to be around. I'll go for that. One resident pointed out that other controlled substances are sold in drugstores with specific instructions for how much and when they should take the medication. But since there aren't any dosage recommendations for medical marijuana, patients can go overboard when deciding how much they need. Except that I don't think there's been any evidence to show that there's a toxic level of marijuana. which is compared to a lot of the most prescription medications, and certainly alcohol and tobacco, is benign. I mean, anything can be abused, and marijuana can be abused as well, for sure. You don't want to use it while you're driving or operating heavy equipment, or you don't want to be drinking, for that matter, or using even prescription medications. But, you know, it's clearly these kinds of special pleading arguments are designed to whip up sentiment and fear that isn't particularly justified in this case, and it's a throwback to a worser era that we hoped that we'd gone beyond. And, of course, we haven't. Having it in drugstores makes sense if it were legal, Scotts Valley Mayor Din Budici said. I would be all for that, but federal law, notice they say federal law, not state law, because the initiative may pass next time in 2012 to legalize marijuana if one gets on the ballot. So that's the issue here. No, we have a federalist system in the United States that allows states to experiment with different kinds of laws, and federal law does not trump state law in every situation, and indeed, Obama administration supposedly, although it doesn't seem to be operating this way, has been saying that it's not going to be enforcing the absurd anti-marijuana federal law against medical marijuana patients in states where it's permitted. So these are a series of arguments that I think really are either very ignorant or simply a cover story for something else, which is that there are certain pressure groups that don't want to see marijuana legitimized. And the real tragedy here is that this continues to result in a huge racket of criminalizing many, many people. The number of arrests for marijuana have reported continuously gone up, both nationally at a state level and locally in Santa Cruz. And that's something that is not very well publicized except on this station by me, but that is documented by even the Santa Cruz Police Department in its report to the moribund Measure K Commission, which supposedly made marijuana the lowest enforcement priority, but actually has been doing no such thing and has been letting the police department do whatever it wants, which is run by the same mentality that seems to run the Scotts Valley City Council and staff. So I think the Julia Vinograd poetry that I was going to read from When Even the Sky Hurts, we'll have to wait until Sunday. I suspect we're not going to be on the air on Sunday. We'll be on the stream unless something very unusual happens. But I will be here anyway, doing a show that people can listen to on their computers, and hopefully they can also download later as an archive. So that's not ideal, but it's kind of what we're stuck with at the moment. Thank you, those of you who were patient enough to listen to this show, even after the first half hour was eaten up by something else. And because when I came in, I got the misimpression that we weren't able to stream. And let's see if there's anything else. Hope to see you, I guess, on Saturday at 11 o'clock for making signs at the town clock, and then at 12 o'clock for speaking out against the wars, the war on the poor and the war against poor people abroad, because that's really mostly what it is. The insurgents in these countries are mostly poor people, is my sense. They're people who aren't part of the established power structure, who aren't, you know, part of the corrupt Karzai government, or part of the corrupt Iraqi government, part of the other governments that the U.S. is so heavily funding, all with the excuse that it's fighting terrorists. It's always very nice to brand the opposition terrorists. That's a nice way of avoiding issues and making it a simple black and white measure for these huge congressional majorities to vote for. But, of course, it's just not the case. And it's a war criminal policy that's murdering essentially millions of people over the course of the last decade, and it has to be stopped. We're going to try to do our bit towards stopping it on Saturday. And we need to invite you to get, you know, vital locally around these issues. Stop supporting businesses, corporations that fund this war effort. Remove from office politicians who won't categorically oppose the military. Far is a problem. He votes for the military half the time. We have a caller. Hi, caller. You're on Free Radio. You better make it quick, Drum Circle, Dave. We only got about a minute.
Hey, yeah, wanted to get a hold of you and say, hey, the Drum Circle went real well, and no cops came, and it was a real blast, and great to be here, and eat some kelp, Santa Cruz, and some tuna fish.
But before
fish, if you can get it.
Let me interrupt you, you seaworthy guy. Did you have a Drum Circle after dark?
Yeah, we did, all the way to 10 o'clock.
And so they didn't come in. I know I got the word from James in the Rain, James Mattson, that he's still being tried for being in a forbidden area after dark, in the very area where you were doing your drum circle.
Oh, really? But he didn't sign that ticket.
It doesn't matter. He's gotten a citation. He's going to court, and he's going to be going to court in April to fight that. So you might want to organize the drummers to support him in court.
Oh, I will, definitely. Hey, thank you, Robert, for a heads up on that one, yeah.
Hey, well, thank you for, you know, regularly calling in and trying to monitor the situation.
Oh, yeah, and hey, sorry, I missed your show tonight. I don't know if you got to play any of that guy today off of the recording of Corals.
I don't think so. I think we have a problem. We're not really broadcasting. We're only streaming on the Internet because we were having transmitter problems. But,
I don't have you on the radio. I only got you on the computer.
Yeah, well, at least you got us on the computer. That's positive. That's the first I've heard that's actually confirmed from somebody who's not in the studio. So
yep.
I'm glad.
I can't get you on the airwaves, the antennas. Something's up.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's not happening. We've got transmitter problems, but we'll hopefully in the next week, although it may take a while for us to resolve them, we're going to deal with them. And I'll be back on Sunday and talking some more at you.
Yep. Hey, Rob, you take it easy, huh?
You too, man.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broad System. Expecting Uncle Dennis in the studio momentarily. He told me he's coming in, and he'll be doing his show. So that's going to be happening. I'm going to play a little more of the infamous Eli Charleston's Ragged Time. Let's listen to The Sweat of Solid Ground. Or do my eyes deceive me? Well, let's hear how our ears take it.